You mentioned existentialism and nihilism. They are familiar Western philosophical sort of ideas. Mm-hmm. So it's not, so I understand that Buddhism philosophy approach is not one and not another. How other like Western philosophical ideas like solipsism or materialism, how do they see it? Because when you describe everything is just in your own mind, it's nothing there.
Well, it's not to say that there's nothing there, but it's rather like, well, Wittgenstein, mm-hmm. and my other German phrase, wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen.
Thank you.
One of my few German sentences, badly pronounced, but whatever cannot be spoken of, the mind must necessarily pass over. We can only meaningfully speak about what we experience, and if language and concept can't describe it, can't address it, then it has to be left aside. There's a number of things like materialism, speaking about the four elements as attributes of material form, but not anything that's absolutely fundamentally kind of real and substantial, is part of Buddha's teaching. So Buddha Dhamma is not materialistic. Solipsism, the idea that the mind conjures up everything and there isn't really anything there at all, that my mind is the only real thing in the universe and everything else is just conjured up.
Something. Maybe I don't understand detail, but it sounds very similar to what you were describing.
Well, I didn't study philosophy at university, but the little bit I know, Bishop Berkeley, after whom Berkeley in California is named, was a philosopher, and he talked about solipsism, the idea that things only exist when you pay attention to them, and that because he was a bishop grounded in Christian theology, he took it as a proof of the existence of God, that things sustain themselves, that God is always watching everything. Therefore, the world of things sustains itself. So that was, as I understand, Bishop Berkeley's part of his philosophy. And to come up with another quotation that sort of sits in my memory, as a limerick that describes this, or two limericks, these kind of five-line poems. There was a young man who said, God must think it exceedingly odd to find that this tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. Because Bishop Berkeley talked about this oak tree out in the quadrangle of his college, as an example. And then the answer to that is, dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad. That's why this tree will continue to be, signed, yours faithfully, God. So that's a kind of synopsis of Bishop Berkeley's thesis. So the Buddha wasn't teaching that, but he tried to keep it kind of simple and clear. And so this, I feel that the Buddha's approach is very accurately echoed in the phenomenological teachings of people like Husserl in European philosophy. Also, you have in materialism or Plato's philosophy of the realm of ideal forms, the eidolon, the primordial microphone or the primordial person or cushion, or that there's a realm of ideal forms that cushion participates in the ideal, the ultimate ideal cushion that exists in this sort of different plane. So that's definitely not connected to the Buddha's thinking or idea. The realm of ideal forms would not fit. But there's probably whole books that line up Western philosophy and Buddhist teachings that I have not read. But a few of those prominent teachings, like solipsism or materialism, I would say they veer away from what the Buddha taught. And in the Buddha's own time, there's quite a few of the other spiritual teachers who had those kind of views, that had the nihilistic view, what's called the Uccedavada or Sasatavada, the eternalist views and so on. But within Buddha Dhamma, there's no concept of a creator God. There's no concept of an ultimate beginning of things. There's a whole chapter of the Connected Discourses which is on the no definable origin, a whole series of suttas that talk about how you can't describe an origin or an ultimate beginning of things. So that veers away from sort of theistic philosophies or the universe created by a supreme deity, very definitely. So those religious philosophies are the Buddha's teaching is far away from. He is kind of unique in focusing on the philosophy in terms of how it can transform you as an individual from a state of suffering to liberation. That's his sole purpose. He wasn't trying to describe the nature of the universe as a theory or an idea. It's like, what do you do to make a difference with your life? Over and over again, he said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. He was very adept at picking up the philosophies and ideas and views that people had, and then like a wonderful magnifying glass of focusing it down to like what really makes a difference. I don't know how valuable it is to explore those different parallels, but there are some touch points that I say that is quite close, like I say, with phenomenology. But the purpose of the Buddha wasn't trying to create a philosophical description of the universe, but rather giving practical tools to human beings, living beings, as to how to work with the experience of the present and this life, to use the opportunity to enable the citta to awaken to reality and to be liberated. Over and over and over and over again, that's the purpose that he focuses on.
Yeah, it feels like it's other way around, because philosophies usually try to create philosophy from which you pull down how to live your life, but Buddha is other way around.
Other way around, yes.
Talking about how to live your life and that people like trying to create philosophy out of it. So probably it's why it's so, for me at least, it's a little bit other way around.
Yes, yes. And so many people got into dialogues with the Buddha and trying to sort of prove him wrong or try to promote their own philosophy or you can almost sort of feel the Buddha rolling his eyes like, oh. This is what makes a difference.
Yeah, because it's wrong thinking.
Yeah, that's how I would read it, that he's extraordinarily patient with a broad variety of different views and opinions that people had, and over again it's just bringing it back to dukkha and the ending of dukkha.
What the net of views in the first discourse of the 62
wrong views, yes.
62 wrong views that the Buddha elucidates in his day.
And he was quite aware that the way he spoke was frustrating to people. So when they say, well, what happens to an enlightened being when the body passes away? They must feel some really fantastic result that comes from all of this, and that after the body's gone, where does an enlightened being go? He wouldn't utter a peep, not a word on that. This is how to practice to arrive at realization. What happens after the death of the body? It doesn't speak about it. Or the ultimate beginning of things, like over and over again, no discoverable beginning. But you've got to have some theory about where this all came from and where life and the mind and the universe, and nope. He was seemingly quite content with people misreading his approach. That if you knew, you would say, that's your assumption. To me, it's amazing how he's very stoic. Stoicism from the Greeks, I would say, is quite close to Buddhist practice. He's quite stoic in like, okay, what you say is not what I teach. What I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. And that he was not drawn on that, talking about what happens to an enlightened being after the death of the body or the ultimate beginning of things. Or he was, in a sense, recognizing that people were going to misunderstand him, misread him and misrepresent him. And then when it was appropriate, he would spell out how people were mistaken. But he really didn't budge from that clarity and that focus right from the earliest times. It's really remarkable, amazing and wonderful that he was so clear from the very beginning and just stayed on that track of a very practical set of tools that people can use to bring about their realization of the mind to know and to embody Dhamma.